Welcome to Discussions in Depth Psychology. I'm Bonnie Bright, and this series, as you know by now, is powered by Pacifica Graduate Institute. And it's also dedicated to bringing you some discussions with some of the individuals who are doing some really remarkable work and contributing in profound ways to the field of depth psychology. And today my guest is Dr. Andrew Samuels, who is a psychotherapist, professor, an activist, and a writer. Thanks so much for taking time to speak with me today, Andrew.
It's my pleasure. I'm really looking forward to having something to do with Pacifica again. You know, in 1992, I was a visiting scholar. I stayed there for 2 weeks. I slept in a room that used to be slept in by Greta Garbo. And I was there over the period of time that Bill Clinton was inaugurated. So I have a long-standing relationship with Pacifica and with politics, obviously, which we'll talk about in a moment. But I'm very happy to be here.
Absolutely. And boy, I learned something that I didn't know about Pacifica before. I had no idea that Greta Garbo had been in that room. That's kind of a remarkable energy to have around the campus, for sure.
Yes. I slept very badly.
Well, that's a whole different conversation, I guess. But at any rate, that's really fantastic and so interesting to hear. So it does sound like you've had a long history with Pacifica. And of course, you are going to be presenting at the upcoming conference, which takes place in October of 2017. And that is called Up Against the Wall, Politics, Community, and Psyche, which is a really fascinating kind of combination. I think that many of us who are in depth psychology probably do often think of those things as being related, but maybe not everyone does. So we'll really have a chance to dive into that a little bit today. And just for everyone's information, if you're interested in that, you can go to the Pacifica site at pacifica.edu, then click on events, and then there is this thing called the retreat, which offers all of those kinds of conferences and things. So you can find it there. Meanwhile, Andrew, I'd like to go ahead and read your bio so that we have it here so everyone can have a little more background on you, and then we'll jump
good.
In.
Good.
Great. Andrew Samuels, PhD, is recognized internationally as one of the foremost political commentators and theorists from the perspectives of psychotherapy and depth psychology. He has worked as a consultant with political leaders, parties, and activist groups in several countries, including the U.S. He also consults to Britain's National Health Service. He draws on a wide range of approaches to psyche, including post-Jungian, relational, psychoanalytic, and humanistic ideas, but he roots his work in citizens' lived experience, which I think is so critical, and we'll talk about that. That's definitely, for me, a depth psychological approach. He roots his work in citizens' lived experience and in what can be learned from therapy work carried out with political awareness. While Andrew does not disguise his background in progressive and left-wing politics and his commitment to diversity and equality, he remains open-minded and celebrates many different takes on social and political issues. So let's just jump in. No reason to delay. You know, I would say that we have a number of different political issues that seem to be just growing by the day. And this has probably always been the case, but I think the media highlights them on some level. We have all kinds of things around the terrorist threats and attacks that have just seemed to multiply over the last few years. The specter now of nuclear strikes because of what's happening with North Korea and others. There's a very controversial U.S. administration and some policies that are going on right now. And of course, this was all kind of initiated in some ways by the Brexit, which I'm sure you've had a lot of things to say about. So there's any number of issues that can speak to really the idea of kind of a global crisis right now as it's happening to politics. And yet on some level, it's probably business as usual. So your most recent book is entitled A New Therapy for Politics. I'm curious about how you got into this area and really what brought you to this point.
You know, listening to your list of political issues, it makes me realize what a hard thing it is for a therapist to talk about politics, because on the one hand, can she or he say anything that an intelligent journalist wouldn't already say? And on the other hand, we descend into psychobabble, whether it's language of projection and paranoia, or whether it's the language of archetypes, because the Jungians are pretty bad at making themselves completely incomprehensible to ordinary people. We are caught. You know, it's very hard to find a middle way. I think about this a lot because my background is primarily politics. I was into politics long before I was into theater, and I was into theater long before I was into psychotherapy. I've been very lucky because top politicians, for various reasons, have hired me as a consultant. I won't mention actual names, but let's just say presidential and prime ministerial level. So I have a lot of very difficult, very disillusioning, sometimes hands-on experience. And this question of how therapists speak about politics is a really, really tricky one. Make no mistake, it's not a new thing. A lot of people cite that book by Hillman and Ventura from 1992, but you know, Freud was writing about politics in the 1890s. And Jung wrote about politics, sometimes a little misguidedly, throughout his entire career. I mean, he was very aware of how the political world penetrates into the silent, pure space of the consulting room. So we are not new, those of us who are interested in this interface between therapy thinking and politics. The problem is, what we don't do is ask, why have we been so magnificently unsuccessful? Nobody really listens to what therapists have to say. I mean, obviously, if someone writes a book about a president who suffers from pathological narcissism, a few thousand people will buy it, but they're mostly therapists already. So we really do have to address why nobody listens. I've already mentioned that we become completely caught up in our own language and our own concept. But you know, we have a shocking history. We've not been very good with minorities, whether they're sexual or ethnic slash racial slash cultural minorities. We operate a very undiverse kind of profession. And our own politics, our professional politics, are such awful shit, to be honest, that it's not surprising that people wonder, who the hell are these people? So here's my solution to the problem of the failure of the project in which I have been involved and which I spent my whole adult life as an activist. The solution is, don't do it alone. Find people to do it with. Find groups that will respond to therapy thinking. I think Pacifica is doing some of that. And I think it's a very unusual, because most therapists just sit there, write their blogs or they write their papers, and that's it. They don't actually really get down there with other people and do things. So to summarize my answer to your question, which is probably quite a long answer, I've been very lucky. I have had directly relevant experiences which have helped me see what a problem we have in speaking it right, speaking it in a way that gets through to people and isn't just about proving our theories to be correct. And I think we also have a problem in owning that this is an uphill struggle and that we need to work with other groups of activists, whether they are ecologically minded, whether they are communities of faith, whether, and this is very important to me, there are people working in the economic and social justice area, because it's a hard one for therapists. We're great on the environment, you know, we're not so good on social class. That's that's my answer to your question.
Yeah. Well, it's really fascinating to start thinking about it in those terms, because politics is really a collective thing. And so why would we not, you know, be addressing this in groups, as you mentioned, and having not only that support of other people that are around us, but also finding ways to really get involved and take that out into communities as almost a kind of activism. I think that a lot of people who end up, I mean, this is a very vast generalization, but I feel like a lot of people who end up as a practicing therapist or are interested in psychology often have that tendency to be a little more introverted. And yet there are so many opportunities for people to get involved and to actually take that outward and to be able to do things with it. But it is important to have that capacity for reflection, I think, before we jump in and do things too.
But not too much reflection.
Not too much reflection.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. Yeah. You know, to use Hamlet's language, reflection is cyclid with the pale cast of thought, and we lose the name of action. Mm-hmm. I think therapists are brilliant at thinking and reflecting and sitting and sharing and so on. But I'm all for mindlessness. Sometimes you have to get into the roughness of politics. If you go on demonstrations, and although I'm in my late 60s, I go on demonstrations all the time. It's rough. Mm-hmm. And the slogans are mindless. And the slogans are simplistic. And we don't like it because we're all about on this side, on that side, what's the middle path? Jungians talk about the transcendent function, the conjunction of opposites, and there really aren't opposites in a political field that is riddled with inequality. If you are neutral in a situation of inequality, then you're not being neutral. You are siding with the powerful in right. that situation.
Yeah.
See
yeah.
this, for example, I'll give you one example, the Middle East. Everybody says, well, you have to look at the Palestinians' responsibility, you have to look at the Israelis' responsibility, whatever. Find the middle balance point of view. And this might be okay if you're doing clinical work with an individual about her father. Okay, find a balanced view. But if you're talking about politics, the only psychological approach that works is one of passion. And you don't need to worry about taking over the situation because there's always somebody there to oppose you and tell you you are wrong. There's always the opponent. And I think the opponent is what a lot of people forget about. That's what distresses me about some of the writings and speeches about Trump. People forget that there are other people with different points of view, but they're not in the room, they're somewhere else. So I get very, very concerned when therapist commentators and politics appeal for moderation, the middle way, balanced. I think that the balanced point of view is middle-aged, middle-brow, and middle-class. Hmm. And by the way, male.
Hmm.
Because
yeah.
the man sits there and he judges. You know, you say this, you say that. I don't want to be that kind of a political person.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate too that, I mean, obviously you're recognizing certain characteristics that sometimes go unspoken. So this is the whole work of depth psychology, right? To look at things that are marginalized and look at the voices that have been silenced or that are feeling unable to express themselves. I'm curious because you've really been kind of establishing a premise here for the reasons that people in psychology, depth psychology especially, might be involved in politics, might have reasons to get involved, to have those opinions. You mentioned how Jung and Freud have been involved for a long, long time. You also have in your works, and by the way, you have an amazing body of work at your website, which is andrewsamuels.com, so I hope people will go there and check it out. But you refer to the term political turn relating to psychotherapy, psychoanalysis, and Jungian analysis. Is that where you're going with that? What do you mean by it? Are we getting more involved, or is it something that's happening in the world today that is
okay? Showing? There's two things. Firstly, this political turn is not just confined to Jungians. It includes all kinds of psychoanalysts, humanistic psychologists, especially person-centered therapists, people working in the arts therapies. Forgive me if these are the British terms for these things, but people listening and watching this will understand exactly what I'm talking about. This is not the property of any school of psychotherapy, although opposition to it is found in certain schools more than others. I might come back to that. It's not important. What's important is that we are getting better at integrating those political and collective perspectives into responsible relational clinical work. As you said, I've done a lot of writing, too much damn writing. I'm fed up with writing. But I did some empirical research and I asked therapists all over the world from different schools in different countries, what did they do when the patient or client brought politics into the consulting room? What they all said was, we would really like to do better with it than our training has equipped us to do. We don't quite know what to do. So I spend a lot of time trying to find ways that are congruent with good clinical practice, they're not just wild, that enable a therapist to think about how to work with the person's political concerns, obsessions, and even to work with people whose political opinions are very contradictory and digressive from their own. And this working with political material, I don't know if I'll do this party piece of mine at Pacifica, but if anybody asks, I certainly will, is really very important because getting the political into the consulting room gives us the ethical base to get what we learn in the consulting room into the political arena. The first place to do the therapy and politics game is in the session. Then you can take your psychotherapeutic ideas and go out and work with an environmental group or a group involving an ethnic minority. The ethnic minority is the British phrase. It probably doesn't mean much in America, but that's the phrase we tend to use. So it's a two-way street. You have to bring the political angle into therapy systematically and professionally, not just announce that you want to do it, but actually figure out how you're going to do it, especially working with people that you don't agree with and who don't agree with you. This is the hard one. Mm. Lots of different ways to approach it. There is a rhetorical device that says, well, you work with people whose views on relationships, whose views on art, whose views on how to do therapy are very different. And that doesn't stop you doing therapy with them. Why is it so difficult to do therapy with a person whose political views are widely or wildly discrepant from your own? It is hard, though, because politics is all about dispute and struggle and disagreement. Nevertheless, that is the task. You cannot just do therapy in a political vein in front of a mirror. You have to imagine, for me as an old lefty, I have bankers. I have conservatives. I have people who voted for Brexit. I have people who have expressed secret sympathies for Trump and say if they were an American, or indeed I have Americans, yeah, Trump, interesting new development, da-di-da-di-da. You know, you cannot get apoplectic about this, and you should not go silent. Somewhere between silence and the outrage, there's a path that has to be worked out by the clinician. And then, as I say, that clinician can cut the mustard when they leave the consulting room and go into activist circles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I really appreciate what you're saying. What I'm hearing is that basically, I mean, there's multiple paths we could take, whether they're in a therapist or a psychologist of any type. One is that we can just go to our sort of tower and write about it and put it out there in more or less of a vacuum. Another way also is to avoid the topic as much as possible. And of course, anyone who has close friends or family who has political views that are different than their own probably can identify with that on some level. We can also argue it, but this idea of actually welcoming it, embracing it, and bringing it right there in front of us so that it's no longer just the elephant in the room, but actually addressing it and allowing oneself, I think, to be open to those opposing points of view sometimes is absolutely so critical, because that's what allows the space for something new or different to happen. So I'm hearing you say
I say, I think it's wonderful that you brought in the family. Because one of the things that I do, and I'm going to do it at Pacifica, I'm doing a lecture on the Saturday and a workshop on the Sunday. The lecture is going to cover some of this ground, but in more detail and with more interaction with a group. But on the Sunday, I'm going to do what I used to call a political clinic. The very first political clinic I did was back in 1992. In Pacifica, in some enormous theater in Santa Barbara, as I remember, cavernous great place. We had a decent audience, but they were completely lost in this auditorium. I wonder what it was called. Anyway, somebody will know. In a political clinic, we look at exactly what you just raised. How was politics dealt with and transmitted in your family? Are your personal political engagements aligned with or along the same lines as your parents? Or maybe your parents didn't have similar political views. Do you talk about that with your therapist or analyst? Actually, many people simply have never done that in any depth. How politics was part of their background familial experience. And then there is no such thing as a unified citizen. A man is different from a woman. A heterosexual is different from somebody with another sexuality. Issues of color, class, faith, nationality, location, all of these make for a multiplicity, a plurality of citizens. And this is very important, because the theory seems to state, as it does, by the way, across psychology generally, there's just one person, one type of person is what I mean. And that means one type of citizen. So in a political clinic, I set up a situation in which people can really explore the psychological intricacies of their personal political views and can discuss it with people and share it with people. And my experience is that this is not, it's often not something they've done clinically. They may have chatted with their analyst or therapist about a political theme, but actually looking at one's background, the psychodynamic, the traditional psychodynamic quest of therapy, but to do that with politics in mind is often, except in a situation where a father is like a little Hitler or something, it's often not done in therapy. So the political clinic is pretty amazing stuff. We do a lot of nonverbal stuff. We do sculpting, we do sounds, we do movement, we do improvisations, we do political fantasy about each other, which is a really amazing thing. And I won't say any more than to say it's absolutely sensational experience to be encouraged to fantasize politically about another person in the room. Mm-hmm. So this is what I've done. I've taken stuff I've learned in the clinic and I've actually systematized it. I haven't made it into something that would have a trademark sign or something like that. But it's not just something I'm doing casually. It's something I've been doing for a very long time. And I'm glad I've been doing it for a long time because it can get out of hand. It can get pretty hairy.
I can imagine. Yeah.
Yeah. But you started me on that answer. This is not something I expected to talk about. This whole question of politics and the family is fascinating. And that segues into money. How was money transmitted in the family? What about the gender dimensions of money, which are still colossal in Western developed countries, where you'd think they wouldn't be anymore, but they really, really are, as we know. Pay rates, who gets to be on boards of directors and all of that kind of thing. But again, I turn it back to the family of origin. How did your mother and father handle money? What did you feel about that? And how do you handle money now? Are you satisfied with how you handle money in your current family or relationships or in your life as a whole? These are very important questions. And it gets us away from the up there archetypal games.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, this is really important what you're saying, because obviously everything is interconnected. And by the time you have that base of however you were raised and whatever influences you had from family, whether you are the same, feel like you're the same or carry those same beliefs now, or whether you have actually shifted and moved away from that in some way, all of it affects everything that we do. It affects job choices, to your point, the money thing. I mean, there are so many things that are political that sometimes we don't even realize they are. I was just thinking, for example, because you've mentioned environmental in a couple of sentences here. And I was just thinking, I have a really profound interest in the mass vanishing of the honeybees, something that's called colony collapse disorder.
Yes.
The honeybees have been vanishing for a long time. It's a very political issue. I don't necessarily consider myself all that political, but the whole reason that some scientists are saying the bees are vanishing is because of pesticides and also pollution. And I mean, there's so many things that are related to that. So I think this idea of examining it, particularly in the therapy room, can be so powerful. It seems clear to me that you are convinced that therapy can have an impact on some of these social and political problems, beginning with the individual, but obviously out into the society. Is
that it can have an impact if we play a game with other people. I have a slogan which I've used on TV here, and I've said it so many times, so I apologize to anyone who's heard it before. You know, when there's a public committee or policy commission to address a social issue, for heaven's sake, let's try to get a therapist onto that commission, onto that committee. But for God's sake, let's never have a committee entirely of therapists. That would be a complete nightmare. And this is hard for us, you know, even when people do placements and things like this, the pendulum swings back to the psychological. There's a new word around, which, well, it's not that new, but its growth is interesting. Psychosocial. This is a very good word. We have it here a lot. Psychosocial studies, departments of psychosocial studies, journals of psychosocial studies. But corny language, boring language, but it is expressing something very, very important that people are getting hold of. That these things are deeply integrated. We don't just project our shit and stuff into the world, nor do we just absorb what the world has in it. It's a mixture.
You know, I've also been hearing this word, since you bring it up, the term social spirituality as well, which for me flips that just a little bit. It's not quite the same as psychosocial, but it's also bringing or introducing that whole idea of spirituality into the mix of things. And I'm wondering if you, what your thoughts are about that particular term.
Yeah. And did you know that I used that term?
I'm not sure where I picked that up. So possibly.
I first published in a book called Politics on the Couch in 2001. Social spirituality works like this, and it's a very interesting but very intricate concept, and a lot of people have never experienced it. When you do something political in a group of like-minded people, whether it's a small group or a huge movement, it could be a whole trade union or something like this, what starts as a social activity sort of receives a kind of rein. The groupishness of it, the togetherness of it, transcends the social and makes it into something more spiritual. Charles Peguy, who's a French writer on these things, said everything starts in mysticism and ends in politics, but I think he got it the wrong way around. A lot of things that start in politics end in mysticism. So social spirituality is this spiritual rain that descends on a social activity done by people in a group. Now, that sounds terrific, and it is. However, unfortunately, it's not all ecologists or people who are interested in the rights of Native Americans or people who are worrying about the destruction of the bees that form groups and do things that get them that feeling of social spirituality. Rather nastier groups of people get the same thing. Right-wing people, fascists, rednecks. The thing people don't understand about the spirit is it's neutral. It's so frustrating. It's neutral. But the good part is that it's for us to determine its political direction. And that's a short summary of this idea of social spirituality I've been pushing for quite a while. I think it's very, very, very important. Now, clinically, you will find clients, patients who have never had that experience. They simply haven't been in a group of people doing politics. Never mind if it's fascist politics or socialist politics, it really doesn't matter at this point. They simply have no idea what that's about. They have never had a groupish experience that produces that funny mixture of politics and spirituality. It's a hell of a deficit.
Well, I think that this whole idea of social spirituality is really an important one, and the awareness of it, the awareness that it even exists. So it's so fascinating that you actually are the one who's been using that term. I'm sure I picked that up somewhere.
I think so, but I think so. It doesn't matter. But the bit I add to all my writing on spirituality is that there is a terrible shadow of spirituality, which Jungians in particular don't discuss. Shall I tell you what it is? It's not completely relevant to our discussion.
Well, I think it's important because it's sort of starting to move into the politics of the therapy profession itself.
Actually, I'm going to make it relevant to our discussion. The biggest element in the shadow of spirituality is elitism. And elitism is the most pernicious political phenomenon in the Western developed countries at the moment. And something fascinating on the level of personal relationships has been going on in these countries, which is, in the old days, somebody from a very good aristocratic, blue-blooded, 400 in New York terms family, but with no money, marries someone from a commercial, mercantile, common, we say in England, background. And so you have the aristocrat and the millionaire put together. These days, rich people marry rich people. The elite has found a trick to perpetuate itself, and it's a really fascinating thing. So the shadow of spirituality, which is the feeling that you are an elite, you are better than other people, you know more than other people, you're special, you've been chosen, all this kind of thing, that also chimes with this colossal problem in America specifically, but also in all the other Western countries, of the elites, the 1%. So it's a fascinating thing to see how right across the board, from spirituality to economics, elitism is a real problem, and inequality is the unspoken thing. And the therapy world has a big problem with inequality. Firstly, of course, therapist and client may not be equal in a completely straightforward way. Secondly, the whole thing is organized hierarchically. You know, you have top people who have names and reputations and CVs, and they get invited to give lectures here and there, and they talk to other people who are also like that. You understand, the whole thing is very pyramidal. And I don't think we have actually introduced equality, and we certainly haven't introduced diversity in any meaningful, inclusive way to our field. And this is something I will mention, because it's a huge, huge problem.
Actually, I just wanted to comment on what you were just saying, and that is that as you were speaking about the hierarchy that often occurs, or the elitism that happens within the psychotherapy profession, we do see that also because of the issues going back to money once again as well. A lot of times psychotherapy is so expensive or not necessarily affordable to everyone that sometimes you do see that only certain groups of people can actually afford to go there. And so that gets us into a whole other question. Sure. about the issues around social inequalities.
You're right.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about Jung's writings about the Jews and Africans.
Yeah, I'm quite known for this. I concluded that Jung, in his writings, did display a definite anti-Semitic side, and I don't feel good about saying this. Nevertheless, there's no point in denying it. We need to be transparent, and I think the Jungian community, especially the analysts, have done a hell of a lot to look into this, to apologize for it where appropriate, and to understand Jung's limits in this matter. So I'm not going to go over that very much. It's all in my book, The Political Psyche. Is about 200 pages on Jung and anti-Semitism in the 1930s. I think we've done, as I say, a fair job of responding to the challenge that the civilized, cultivated world has faced us with. Is what are you going to say about this? When it comes to Jung's writings on, in quotes, Africans, we've hardly begun. There's lots of debates about this in the Jungian world at the moment. I personally think that people of color are put off becoming therapists, not only by the money that you've been talking about and we've been talking about, but also by knowing something of what Jung says about Africans. Now, I'm not going to summarize it. Now, I suggest people look at Michael Van Noy Adams's amazing book, The Multicultural Imagination. But there's a real difficulty in understanding that there is something for the Jungian professional community to own, to take responsibility for, and to make it absolutely clear that we don't believe that Africans are like monkeys, or that Black Americans are like monkeys. We don't. Nor do we believe that people from an African background lack a whole layer of the mind. Nor do we think that people who come from Africa are like white or European babies. You know, obviously we don't. But are we saying that we don't? I mean, a few people like Mike Adams, whose book I just mentioned, or Polly Young Eisendrath, or myself, or Fanny Brewster, who will be at this conference, who is the absolute star of this field right now. Mm-hmm. There are a few individuals, but most Jungian analysts worldwide just stick their heads in the goddamn sand, and they don't want to look at it, and they don't understand how it damages the good things about Jungian psychology. So it's something that really has to be opened up, and I probably will open it up a little bit. Not a lot. I haven't come to Pacifica to talk about that specifically. Nevertheless, I think we can do what we did for Jung's writings on Jewish people in relation to what Fanny calls Africanists, which covers all aspects. And my summer holiday reading was mostly on slavery, so I'm very much with this stuff at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, not light reading. But what you're saying, Andrew, I think is so critical. I just really want to honor that because, you know, many of us, and I will include myself in that, have a tendency to not want to look at Jung as having done anything that might not be appropriate or not what we want it to be because, you know, he was so inspirational for so many people. And of course, he contributed so much to the field. But it's really critical what you're saying, that we absolutely have to be, as with the politics of our families and other people that we know, be so completely open-minded about what might be wrong with some of these scenarios and writing.
That's why the phrase post-Jungian that I coined in the 80s is still the right one, because it means you're connected to Jung, but you're also critical.
Absolutely.
You have to do both. By the way, when I say critical of Jung, I have no interest at all in doing a character beat up on Jung the man. I'm really not interested. I never idealized Jung, actually, so it is easier for me than people who did. That's not the point. The point is, what is our profession, our group, our community, our tribe, if you like, doing about this? And with a few notable exceptions in mind, on the whole, we ain't doing too much.
Yeah. Well, our time is short here. As we begin to wrap up, Andrew, I think that this probably is kind of a segue into this last question or idea I had for you, and that is, you have been writing about what we often call the other, in quotation marks, for many, many years. And so I'm just wondering if you have some last thoughts about what your thinking is on that right now.
On the one hand, the concern about the other, the treatment of the other, is a necessary reparation for colonialism, for heteronormativity, for masculinity, and so on. It's really important to try to redefine our relations with the other. But there's a problem. So much of it suffers from what's still called an Orientalist aspect. That means mixed in with the admiration and the scholarship of the ways and the culture of the other is a kind of sickening patronizing. Isn't it amazing how interesting? Wow, so fascinating, you know. It's a put-down. It's not only an honoring or a repairing of historic injuries done by the majority, the white majority, the powerful majority, the Western or the Northern majority, to other people. It's not only that. It has a kind of control element. So my position on the other is that I'm a bit dubious about the degree to which the psychotherapy and academic worlds have got fascinated by the idea of the other. It's a great thing to do, but at the same time, there are these serious drawbacks to do with this secret saccharine admiration, which is actually controlling, patronizing, and just another kind of colonialism. Mm. I won't say any more about it now. I'll save it till Pacifica.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very intriguing, and I can also just feel some very strong resonance myself in that.
Yeah.
You know, anytime you begin to look at what Pacifica calls psychologies of liberation, and others, of course, as well, but they have a very strong focus on that, you begin to start questioning all of those labels, don't you? Even the ones that are Jungian or the ones that we have really grown up in the professional world with around psychology and depth psychology. Well, Andrew, I'm really appreciative of the time that we've been able to spend together. I know this has been a very quick conversation, but we've certainly touched on a lot of different points that I think are absolutely important, critical, need to be discussed, and could be very, very powerful and fruitful once we have the opportunity to get everyone in a room together and start talking about it. So I really appreciate your suggestion that this needs to be done in groups, and just want to remind everybody again that Andrew will be presenting at the conference Up Against the Wall, Politics, Community, and Psyche, and that takes place at Pacifica Graduate Institute on October 14th and 15th of 2017. So you can go to pacifica.edu and then click on events and then the retreat to find more information about that. Also want to just remind everybody that you can learn more about Andrew and his work and read a considerable amount of his work at his site, which is andrewsamuels.com. Andrew, thank you so much for spending some time with me today.
Thank you. Those were really interesting questions, and I enjoyed the conversation a lot.